And our final presenter for this session is Allison Ward. Allison Ward has a Master's of Science in Health Education from Utah State University and has Health Education Specialist and Improvement Advisor certifications. Ms. Ward has worked in public health for over 10 years and has been involved in public health improvement, health promotion, education, research, policy evaluation, grant development, and grant review from the community and to national levels. Currently, she works at the National Center for Hearing Assessment and Management, where she works with state early hearing detection and intervention programs on implementing high-quality improvement methodologies to improve loss to follow-up with babies who fail their newborn hearing screening. Additionally, Ms. Ward is working to educate the EHDI programs about the prevention and diagnosis of congenital cytomegalovirus. Ms. Ward is involved in the planning and implementation of Utah's HB 81, which mandates the Utah Department of Health to conduct a public-centered and physician-centered education campaign about cytomegalovirus. Ms. Ward, thank you.
Pleasure. So I'm going to echo Lauren's sentiment about what a diverse panel we have this morning, and it's really fascinating to see all the collaboration within public health to improve population health. And I'm certainly going to be looking for the fit dish symbol for my meal tonight. So make it going. I have no relationships to disclose. So who in here has heard about cytomegalovirus? Oh, I am so excited. That's great. Most groups that I speak with, there's really hardly ever any hands that go up. So cytomegalovirus is extremely common. Most of you have actually contracted it at some point in your lives, typically causing flu-like symptoms. There are some people that get extremely sick with it, but it's very few. Cytomegalovirus, or CMV for short, is part of the herpes family, and I'll talk a little bit more about what that means in just a moment. Where cytomegalovirus really causes disastrous effects is if a woman contracts it during pregnancy. And as part of the herpes family, it can either be a primary infection or secondary infection. And what that means is, just like other herpes viruses, they lay latent in the nervous system. And so a woman can have a resurgence of the infection during pregnancy, or can contract a primary infection, so the first time she's ever had the infection during pregnancy. And there's a lot of research that supports the virus really transferring to the unborn baby at a higher rate if a woman contracts a primary infection during pregnancy versus a resurgence or a uprising of the secondary infection. So CMV is an extremely common virus, but as far as the congenital side of it, or a woman passing the virus onto her unborn child, is much more common than we realize. In fact, one in 150 births are babies that have contracted cytomegalovirus during gestation, and one in five of those babies will have permanent disabilities due to the virus. And those disabilities, you can see on this chart here, that CMV actually causes more disabilities than Down syndrome, fetal alcohol syndrome, and a variety of other more well-known conditions. As we'll kind of go through this presentation, you'll see a little bit more about those. And then there's also the issue of symptomatic versus asymptomatic congenital CMV issues when a baby is born. So some babies are born and you can see that they have CMV. There's certain symptoms, and we'll go into that in just a minute, certain symptoms that you can see right off the bat. Typically microencephalopathy, a small head. There's petechiae, which is a systemic rash. So some babies you can tell right off the bat that they have CMV when they're born. Others have delayed sequelae from CMV, particularly hearing loss, things like cerebral palsy that you may not be able to identify until the child is older. So here's some examples of congenital cytomegalovirus impact. The baby up here in the top left was a baby that was identified at birth, small head size or microencephaly. And then the girl over here on the upper right? She has a variety of disabilities related to congenital cytomegalovirus. And then the little boy here on the left, again, cerebral palsy and hearing loss. His CMV was not recognized or diagnosed until he was a little bit older. And then the little girl here on the left, really her only symptom of CMV right now is bilateral profound hearing loss. And I'm going to talk quite a bit about Daisy, who's the little girl here on the bottom right, as we go on. So the reason why I'm involved is, again, like Michelle mentioned, I work at the National Center for Hearing Assessment and Management, and we work with all the state early hearing detection and intervention programs. So, and that's how we were pulled into CMV, and it's really been a very fascinating and very rewarding process. So CMV accounts for about 25% of sensory neurohearing loss in children, and that's, you know, more and more studies are coming out linking CMV to more conditions and related back to more hearing loss. And it's the most common non-hereditary cause of hearing loss. And most of the children, like I was mentioning, most of the children that develop hearing loss related to CMV, it's not recognized in their newborn hearing screening. So it may not show up until, you know, they're 18 months, 2 years old, and sometimes even later. And then the hearing loss is often progressive. So I'm going to, like I mentioned before, I'm going to talk to you a little bit more about Daisy Dutre. She's the little girl in the pink there. So Daisy has the fortunate opportunity to be part of a very involved family in the state of Utah. So this is Daisy right here being held by her grandmother, Senator, Representative Rhonda Menlove. And her mom is right next to her, Sarah Dutre, in the white shirt there. And so Daisy contracted congenital cytomegalovirus during gestation. Sarah had no symptoms of contracting the disease when she was pregnant, and Daisy looked like a totally perfect, normal, healthy baby when she was born. She did start to show really delayed language development, and so they actually, her mom has a master's in special education, and she started wondering, wait, this doesn't seem right. She doesn't seem to be progressing like I expected her to be. And so they went and had her hearing tested, and sure enough, Daisy had profound hearing loss, and she was diagnosed with profound deafness at 18 months of age. And since then, they opted to get cochlear implants. I don't know if you're familiar with those, where there's the amplification, actually, instead of hearing aids. And her speech development is not quite to the state where her hearing peers are, but it's definitely progressed quite a bit. So Rhonda Menlove and her daughter Sarah started to really try to see, well, wait, why is there not more information about CMV out there? Why aren't pregnant women hearing about CMV? Because it is preventable. It's a virus that's passed on, and we'll talk more about that in a minute, that's passed on particularly through saliva and urine of young children. And so it's something that's preventable, and as a preventable illness, that's something we can do something about, right? So it's particularly in public health, and so that's why it's really been pushed into the public health realm. So Rhonda and Sarah really worked to not only educate women in the state, but then they also pulled together a group of partners, including the National Center for Hearing Assessment and Management, to come up with some legislation in the state of Utah, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that legislation. It went into effect in 2013, and there's been some great things that have come from the legislation. So as I mentioned, Sarah and Rhonda really pulled together a pretty dynamo team of individuals from the University of Utah, Primary Children Medical Center, Utah State University, National Center for Hearing Assessment and Management, and then Sarah with a group of other mothers in the state who have had children born with CMV. They pulled together the Utah CMV Council, which is a nonprofit and is doing some really fantastic work. So as far as passing legislation, there's lots of different routes. I I don't know how many of you are familiar with public health legislation. There's several different routes to getting there. The way that the Utah legislation was passed was because we had that one key stakeholder in the legislature that really pushed the CMV legislation. But there's a variety of ways that you can pass legislation in your state. But all of those routes require that you come up with a compelling policy case and demonstrate the vulnerability or the groups that are vulnerable from whatever you're trying to whatever legislation you're trying to pass, and then you're ready to counter any negative arguments, and then certainly show the cost benefit ratio with the policy that you're trying to pass. So the HB 81 is the name of the Utah CMV bill, and it really mandates the Utah Department of Health to do two things, to conduct an education campaign and then target babies who don't pass their newborn hearing screening for CMV screening. And we'll go into more detail. This is an example of one of the outreach efforts for the public education campaign is the signs on the buses. All right, so funding for HB 81. Again, we had that really key stakeholder within the legislature that was able to tie funding to mandates, because as we know, there's lots of mandates that are unfunded, and those, you know, that becomes increasingly difficult to really do a lot of outreach and education when there's no funding tied to the mandate. But fortunately, there was in this case. And so it really, you know, there's been a ton of collaboration between the Utah Department of Health and the legislation to really get this up and going. And it's still, some of the pieces are still in the process of being more and more developed, particularly the education component. So the education piece of the mandate was really twofold. So really to educate women that are pregnant or planning on becoming pregnant, and then also provide information about congenital cytomegalovirus to healthcare providers, to child care providers, school nurses, health educators. So it's really been a pretty broad outreach and still definitely going on. And so why? Why would we really be targeting education? There's been a lot of, or I shouldn't say a lot, but several studies looking at the awareness of congenital cytomegalovirus amongst pregnant women. And awareness is very low, anywhere ranging between 14 to 22% of pregnant women are aware of CMV. And when, you know, going back to that chart where, you know, I was showing the different disabilities, like prevalence of disabilities, I mean, CMV is high up there. It trumps, you know, fetal alcohol syndrome, but yet there's a lot more women that are aware of fetal alcohol syndrome than they are of CMV. And then specific knowledge about CMV is even lower than just general awareness. Okay. And so, actually, I'm going to talk just a little bit. I didn't hit the child care provider. So child care provider, the reason why that piece is in there is that children that are between the ages of 0 and 3 shed the virus more than any other age group. And so, and particularly children that attend daycare seem to have a higher viral load than other children. And so really working with those child care providers, not only, you know, not only for the safety of the mothers of the children they watch, but even of the mother, the child care provider themselves. In fact, Lisa Saunders in Connecticut, she was a child care provider, and she contracted a primary CMV infection when she was pregnant and passed it on to her daughter Elizabeth, who is one of the girls that I showed you in the pictures. And Elizabeth had severe disabilities due to congenital cytomegalovirus, and she did pass away at age 16 from a severe seizure, but had never was a quadriplegic, never spoke, she was blind, she was profoundly deaf, she had severe disabilities from it. And so we want to protect the child care provider as well as the mothers of the children that the child care provider is watching. So the screening provision of the mandate, this is the one that's related to the identified hearing loss. So it directs medical practitioners to test babies who don't pass their first two newborn hearing screenings. So if a baby does not pass its inpatient or its inpatient screening before they leave the hospital, they have to come back for a rescreen because there's lots of reasons. There could be, you know, fluid in the ears and, you know, a variety of things that could settle out over a couple week time period, where the baby's ears clear out and they're actually able to hear better. So if they don't pass their inpatient screening and their outpatient screening, then physicians are required to automatically test them for CMV, and that has some quite a few implications, as we'll see here in just a minute. So the Joint Commission on Infant Hearing recommends that newborn hearing screening is completed by 1 month of age. So that's going to be that inpatient screen and that outpatient rescreen. So both of those pieces need to be done by 1 month. And then the babies receive a diagnostic evaluation for hearing loss by age 3 months, and then are enrolled into early intervention by 6 months of age. And the Utah bill really had an implication on that 1 month marker, as I'll talk about a little bit more in a minute. So the implementation of the education piece, there's been a variety of things that the Utah Department of Health has done in conjunction with the National Center for Hearing Assessment and Management, as well as the Utah CMV Council. There's been a lot of different public awareness campaigns. I showed you the bus earlier. The CMV Council has done a lot of health fairs. So there's been kind of pieces that people have said, you know, we'll take this on and oversee certain components of the education. NCHAM hosted the CMV Public Health and Policy Conference. We just had the conference in September, and it was extremely successful. We thought it would initially just be a regional conference, but we ended up having about 320 people attend the conference from 7 different countries and 33 different states. And so we were really happy about the success of that conference. And it really went anywhere from, you know, parents attending, you know, parents of that have children with CMV, to researchers, to people in public health. So it was a very, very broad conference and really just rich with information. And then education with child care providers. We've been working with the Child Care Licensing Bureau, doing some continuing ed with the child care providers in Utah, as well as print, you know, sending printed material with their renewal certifications and things like that. So, like I said, the education component is still very much underway. We actually have a meeting in a couple weeks where we're going to really start working more with the baby, your baby program in Utah that's within the Maternal and Child Health Bureau in Utah. It's a little bit of a different shift. Right now, most of the education is coming out of the Early Hearing Detection and Intervention Program. So prevention through behavior change. This is really where the education component is focused on. Basic hygiene practices are actually the best way to prevent contracting CMV during pregnancy and any other time in an individual's life. So avoiding, like I was mentioning before, the children, toddlers specifically, shed the virus more than any other age group. And so, you know, particularly if a mother is pregnant or planning on becoming pregnant and she has a toddler, which happens all the time, right, that mother should really, you know, reduce kissing the toddler on the lips, sharing a cup with them, sharing utensils with them, and making sure that after they, you know, change their diaper or help them with toilet training, that they wash their hands. So it's really basic hygiene practices that prevent CMV. And I wasn't going to go too much into treatment, but on the treatment side, you know, there's been, you know, quite a few vaccines that have been explored, but we haven't come up with any successful vaccines yet. And as far as treatment of a baby that contracts CMV, has some success, particularly with reducing the hearing loss, but not necessarily reversing some of the really intense disabilities that a child may be born with, particularly if they have if they're symptomatic at birth. So some of those pieces really, they're just not reversible. And so prevention is really our best option right now. Okay, so yeah, so here's the transmission route. So the baby slobbering or the toddler slobbering, and the mom wipes their nose and then touches their face, you know, gets in through the mouth, you know, eyes and nose. And so it's, you know, just like a lot of other viruses, super easy to transmit. And so implementation, sorry, the order of the slides made total sense to me when I put the presentation together. Now I feel like I'm skipping all over the place. So the implementation of the CMV screening, the screening piece is imperative right now because because it has that silent infection piece to it. It's kind of like you don't know what you don't know, right? When a baby is born, that's where the little cartoon comes from of the annual convention of invisible men that it looks like nobody showed up, is you don't know that a child has an infection often if when they're born. So that's the importance of the screening piece. And what is the best method of screening? There's a lot of controversy surrounding that. You know, they've done quite a few testing or quite a few research projects out of the University of Alabama, Birmingham, looking at using blood spot screening as a tool to detect CMV, and that was not as effective as they were hoping it would be. So right now, saliva and particularly the PCR saliva and urine test is the most accurate test. It actually is more of a diagnostic test than a screening tool, but it's the best that we have right now. And so going back to the implications of screening, that it's reduced that one-month marker, like I was mentioning before, to actually fitting in within 21 days. So it's really, as far as the early hearing detection and intervention program, it's really sped up that one-month marker to go down to 21 days. So, you know, the provider outreach is imperative. Working with the hospitals who do the screening is imperative. So it's really taken a lot of coordination between hospitals and audiologists and the Department of Health to really reduce that time to 21 days. And these statistics came from Michael Cannon, a CMV epidemiologist at the Center for Disease Control, that if we reach 1 in 3 pregnant women, we could incur about $1 million worth of savings with mothers and children that contract CMV. And then if we reduce the risk by one-third, we can prevent disability in about 500 children. So to me, that's a pretty awesome, you know, carrot to follow after. I had a fantastic couple parent stories, but I'm not going to be able to hit them. At the CMV Public Health and Policy Conference, we started each plenary with a parent story, which we found extremely powerful. It was kind of a way for us to reconnect of, you know, why we do what we do, because sometimes we have to remind ourselves of that over and over, particularly with the, it reminds me of the presentation in the open plenary yesterday about the angels landing, that sometimes you kind of get stuck right here and you can't remember what you're aiming toward. And so reviewing those parent stories and connecting with parents is a really great way to remind ourselves of that. So I'm going to actually skip over to this one right here. So legislation is one way that we can raise awareness, but there's a variety of other ways that we can certainly raise awareness of CMV as well. So my time is up, so I will conclude. All right.
Great. Thank you very much for all these amazing presentations. So now we'll have time to take some questions and answers for our panelists. I saw your hand first. So you can go ahead.
Public health to be working in with restaurants, and traditionally public health has exercised their regulatory authority over restaurants. And one thing that's helpful for us is that we're an entirely separate division, so the people that are working with restaurants to promote choose several other restaurants are within the Division of Chronic Disease and Injury Prevention, and the group that is inspecting the restaurants is within the Division of Environmental Health. And in our messaging, we work to be really clear that it's explicit on our materials your participation or non-participation or engagement in this program will in no way, is in no way tied to your restaurant grading, and so remember that they're separate. And so we try to be very clear about which group we're from, but I do think overall there is a general need when you're trying to engage in the health department to say, I'm here in an educational and collaborative capacity, and trying to really work that into the messaging, because restaurants aren't always excited to see the health department. I try not to call them with the health department. You try to call them with Choose Health LA restaurants, because it's its own thing. And so I do think it's an important thing to point out. And for purposes of the program, we do keep the activities to be separate. Obviously, the money is very separate, and that's a good thing for keeping clean lines so that we can effectively collaborate.
Hi, good morning. Larry Isaacs, the Commissioner of Health in Nassau County of Long Island, New York. Two quick questions, and I love that this was all over the map because it kept it interesting. We hit on a lot of different categories, and I prefer that to 2 hours of the same thing. But two quick questions, one for Michael, one for Lauren. To Michael, the question that I was wondering is, you may or may not know this, how did the city get the message out that they were doing this training, considering so many people that lived in the area had no power? Their phones went dead, and so even if you are doing trainings, how do you communicate that when all electric is gone? And for Lauren, the question is, some chains naturally have gone on their own nationally, secondary menus, like, I'm not a presenter, so I can take, like the Cheesecake Factory has the Skinny-licious menu. Did you do anything for those companies or chains that have already, are they automatically in your program, or, so what do you do about that?
Sure, I'll just answer that one, which is, there are many places that are working to promote healthier options in their own way, and we really encourage people to have their own branding. And anyone is free to join our program, that's the most important part. But in order to join, you do need to meet our participation criteria. So, for example, the group that you mentioned, that's, from what I understand about that menu, it's based on nutrition criteria, what menu items are included, and they're not necessarily just the same smaller portion. So anybody that has, other things they're doing for health, we think that's awesome. But then in order to participate in our program, they also need to meet our criteria. So, for example, that's part of, what has worked for Subway, right? The soup sandwich, and they have the smaller 4-inch round sandwich. And there's some places that it does work easier for, and there's some places that have to make more changes, and that's just a part of the program. And we encourage all the ways that restaurants are doing healthier options, but for ours, they would also need to meet our criteria.
The answer to my question is, or your question is, some social media, but very limited, and the rest was sort of leafleting, if you will, at the 70 disaster assistance centers in the affected neighborhoods. The idea that people in those neighborhoods that are most severely affected would go to the disaster assistance centers to get resources, that they could also go there for training, and they would receive informational brochures, and then a direct contact by the health department to the NGOs, the larger NGOs, Habitat for Humanity, some of the Salvation Army, some of the religious ones, Occupy Sandy, and a couple of the other ones, just reaching direct out and saying, hey, listen, this is available for your volunteers. If you want to send them to one of these sites, this is when they're going to have these classes. That, and they also work with NYSHO, the Public Housing Authority, to do some for 1-hour programs for the folks that are in public housing.
Rob Amler, Dean of the School of Health Science and Practice. Question for Lauren and question for Lauren. We have a long background on Harry Todd's leading question. On this whole question of restaurants, health departments, and then your wonderful program shows, don't you think that the restaurateur talking to you is also thinking, if I do this, this might save my neck the next time I run into some kind of marginal issue that the health inspectors pick up and say, well, hey, look at the sticker on my window. I'm doing all these other great things. Mm-hmm. And conversely, do you think that the food-eating public could sometimes be a little bit
think that's it's a great question, really, really nuanced. And I would say that I'm a policy lawyer for us. We also work with our county council on how to effectively ensure in as many ways as possible that our program anticipated any legal issues or, as you're talking about, these are issues of politics as well and having people be extremely aware of the role of this program within our department. And I think that there's really two parts, right, of this question. The first is about how do we ensure that people are not unduly influenced or confused by our role. And the second part of your question is, I had it parsed in my head, but I'm like, I have a second part. But we'll go with the first part to begin with. The first part is it's about the grading. I actually like handling that first because we had many conversations about this because LA has a very strong restaurant grading program that people are very aware of, and we found is actually some effectiveness in having restaurants get better grades over time. And what we found with that was we were very careful to not mix the two. Many people said, why don't we use the effectiveness of our grading program and also have our sticker be on this on the placard? And in the end, it was all about keeping those two things very separate in concept. As you can even see by the name, it's not Department of Public Health approved restaurant. It's partner in Choose Health LA Restaurants. And that distinction in the name, that distinction in the way that it's presented is very, I think, important for keeping things separate for the public because we did have awareness that we didn't want the public to be confused by thinking that if you have a sticker, it also means you have an A. Right, because we don't want that because that's not what it means. So currently in LA, you have your placard, and we say that you cannot put this sticker on your placard, you cannot put the sticker on your framed messaging in your restaurant, and then it needs to be kept separate. We also have some of that messaging on our restaurant materials, saying that these two things are separate, and we continue to get to the first original part of the question, to be very careful in our messaging with people about the fact that they are two separate programs, that one will not influence the other effectively, and really to continue to try and explain that. And for the most part, restaurant owners are really savvy people that understand the ins and outs of what it means to be regulated by the health department, and they've been able, because we work so close with people, to really say, okay, I get that you really have no connection, because when they say, can you talk to the, I've had a few, oh, we're having this issue, can you ask a question to the director of the, West Department? I'm like, I don't even know who that is, I don't know anybody, because we work in separate buildings, it's completely separate. And so that's one way that it works, but I do think that it's been very important to have it framed as a partnership with a separate name, and that it's a thing that is needed in ongoing messaging, and we continue to train the people that work on the program, that give messaging. Always remember that you have to explain that you're separate, and in everything that we do, we continue to push that message forward. So I appreciate that question because it's really important, and also that's something that is in, I am also presenting tomorrow in one of the law section presentations, talking about some of the legal issues that come up when you're developing a voluntary program and a voluntary program like this. And so if you're really interested in that stuff, come on over tomorrow.
Thank you, good answer. Question for Dr. Riley. I don't think anything you mentioned in the city program, New York City, touched on vaccines for these homeowners and other volunteers stepping in to take care of problems. But we know that they're more likely to use chainsaws and cutting themselves with dirty nails and so forth. And as you're well aware, in the northern counties of New York, we had tetanus vaccine programs. It was actually DPT vaccine, so they were also given the pestilence. The theory, and since it was the late fall, we slipped in flu shots as well, cotton vaccine. So there was a sort of a three-headed public health initiative, but it began by getting people out there with cotton shots. Anything in New York City? I just don't recall.
As part of this study, no, only because we were dealing with the environmental health group, not the communicable disease group, so it's very likely that they were, but not as it related to the direct worker safety training. There was no associated DPT, although that makes perfect sense, because infectious disease and trauma, that's usually the causes of mortality after disasters. But no, there was not. I just want to qualify what I said to Dr. Commissioner Eisenstein earlier. It wasn't the SHO was that NYCHA, the New York City Housing Authority, that was that disseminated that information to the Brooklyn City.
Yeah, I was the president of the NYCHA.
I know I was. I don't really wake up till 10:30 in the morning anyway, so it's
thank you.
All right. Are there any other questions?
We do have that connotation. I mean, you know, we're based in Florida. Our logo is Florida. You know, we're part of the Public Health Training Center network, where we're all supposed to be is somewhat regionalized with different specialties. We do work through the Suwannee River AHEC, which is accredited to offer CEs nationally. You know, so in terms of, I talked about email blasts with 10,000 people. I would assume that more of them are from the South and Florida. But anyone that's ever participated in any program would get that, so it has been pushed out. We did want to keep it simple with the gender, age, and ethnicity related to the choices of people making. We did back end the site, like with Google Analytics, so we can see where it's being accessed from. You know, in terms of marketing and funding, you know, I think we have limited resources on that, you know, but as I also, we did take a lot of time. It's taken us a long time to build this site, where, and we found it more effective, a lot of things that we do, that we spent a lot of time on every single page building tags onto it. You know, so as I said before, if you type in anything related to Avatar, HIV, AIDS, there's nothing that even pops up in the first, like, three pages other than what we have. So hopefully that might pick up. So.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Oh, go ahead.
One more quick question.
You can leave me.
Before I came to the health department, I had worked as an infectious disease doctor, and this talk was the most talk I've heard about CFV in an organized fashion in many years, which is great. But the question that I have is, even in the infectious disease world, certainly in the context of immunocompromised patients, it's a hot topic. But in the context that you brought it up, I've almost never heard it discussed. And so seems like there was a little bit of luck that you had the right stakeholders have the unfortunate experience of having family that suffered from the disease. How do you recommend in all the other places where those stakeholders don't have that connection that you advance a message like this, which is, in this room a lot of heads went up, but in the general world, most people never heard CFV. So that's the question.
Had too much information in my presentation, because that's a perfect question, is a lot of states aren't prepared to pass legislation because of a variety of issues, including that there's such a lack of benefit from the current treatments for CMV. But I would suggest if legislation is not the best route, to partner up with the early hearing detection and intervention programs. Each state has one. Because it has such a high link to hearing loss, and it's actually within the EDI world, the hearing intervention world, that CMV is becoming more and more recognized as an issue or as a major cause of hearing loss. So working with the EDI programs, also working with MCH programs, the Title V block grants, some of them are starting to include at least a small portion of CMV education. And then there's fantastic parent-run nonprofits. Stop CMV is the biggest one, but there's all sorts of, you know, there's Maddie's Mission in Texas, the Utah CMV Council, and kind of state-specific nonprofits, but Stop CMV is the biggest national parent-run organization. So there's more and more momentum, but you're right, the infectious disease and research component has been the biggest piece of CMV, but that's one of the reasons why we're trying to get the word out there, is there's a really great opportunity to bring it more into the public health prevention realm. So,
All right. Well, thank you all for coming.